Last time we talked about mitosis and karyotypes. And today I want to start by wrapping up karyotypes and then talking a little bit about the details of meiosis. Now, we said that a karyotype is made from a chromosome squash. You put the chromosomes in order so you can examine them. And we discussed what you can learn from looking at a normal karyotype last time, that you can certainly count the number of chromosomes. You can see for each chromosome the morphology, that is the shape and appearance, where the centromere is, how long the arms are, and because of banding, you can identify each chromosome. And therefore, you can get the number of types, which we've called N, and the number of copies of each type, which we've called ploidy. Is there one of each kind, haploid, two of each kind, diploid, three of each kind, etc.? And you can also distinguish sex chromosomes from autosomes. For humans, the sex chromosomes being the X and the Y, whose combination determines the sex, and the autosomes, which is everything else, chromosomes 1 through 22. It's customary in a karyotype to line up the autosomes first in descending order of size and then to add the sex chromosomes at the end. Now, what can you see in an abnormal karyotype? To put it another way, what kinds of abnormalities can you pick up just from looking at the karyotype? Now, you can pick up what we called last time chromosomal mutations, or chromosome mutations. That is, mutations that involve changes in chromosome number or huge hunks of chromosome. You have to remember that a band on a chromosome represents not one gene, but many. And the only thing, rearrangements, deletions, insertions, inversions, the only rearrangements you can see in a karyotype are very large ones that involve visible bands. You can't see so-called gene mutations, mistakes that affect single bases or single or even a few genes, because they're clearly important, but they don't show up in a karyotype. Now, one of the major things you can detect from looking at karyotypes is you can detect what is called aneuploidy. Now, we talked last time about haploid, diploid, tetraploid. In those cases, you have an even number of chromosomes, one of everything, two of everything, three of everything, four of everything. But sometimes you have uneven numbers. You have extras or missing chromosomes, not complete sets. And that's called aneuploid. Now, there's some examples of that on 19B. It's the only part of 19B we didn't do last time. In the middle, there's some pictures taken from your notes. In notes, they're in color. That suppose a normal diploid looks like this. So for this cell, what is N? It's 3. Now remember, N is the number of types. So N is 3, and the ploidy here is how many of each kind? 2. So people would say this is a diploid cell or 2N. Now, on the other hand, in the next example shown here, notice there are 2 of chromosome 1, 2 of chromosome 3, but only 1 of chromosome 2. So this cell is missing a chromosome. It should be diploid, but it's minus 1. So this is called monosomic. On the other hand, the next one has an extra chromosome. It has 3 of chromosome 2, and that's called trisomic. Now, how is this different from triploid? What would a triploid cell have? It would have 3 of everything. So, the ploid is the number of sets. But somic refers to individual chromosomes. Do you have an extra one or a missing one? Now, Now, are there any relatively common or interesting cases of aneuploidy that you can pick up by looking at the chromosomes? It turns out that aneuploidy of most autosomes is lethal. If you have an extra or missing chromosome 1 or 2 or 3 or 4, then the fetus doesn't develop very far, and there is usually what we call a miscarriage or a spontaneous abortion. A large proportion of miscarriages, the material which is miscarried is aneuploid. So it's an aneuploid fetus. The only chromosome aneuploidy that is compatible with growth to adulthood is trisomy 21, also known as Down or Down syndrome, because it was discovered by Dr. Down. Now, what does that mean? That means there's three copies of chromosome 21. But now in the standard karyotype, we start from the biggest chromosome and we go down to the smallest. So that means that a karyotype of someone with trisomy 21, number 20, everything is okay up to 20. And then for 21, there are three, and then there are two 22s. Now, the fact that most autosomal aneuploidies are lethal means that if you have extra copies or missing copies of the respective genes, this is very serious. Presumably because if you have extra copies of a gene, in many cases, you make extra copies of the protein. And if you don't have missing copies of the gene, you don't make enough protein. But in this case, you can tolerate an extra copy of chromosome 21. Now, you might think the only one you could get away with was an extra copy of chromosome 22. But it turns out that 21 really is the smallest chromosome in terms of genetic information. They were originally named on the shape on the... Thanks. They were originally named on the basis of their visible appearance, but it turns out that the actual amount of genetic information in 21 is the smallest. So you can get away with an extra copy of 21. However, people who have trisomy 21 make extra high levels of certain proteins. This is what is called a gene dosage effect. All the genes that they have are normal. But for the genes on chromosome 21, they have three copies instead of two. And therefore, they make three doses of protein from some of those genes instead of two. Thank you. I got it. Wait, yeah. Let's just see if the system's turned up properly. I think I'm going to turn it up a little bit. Is that better? No, it doesn't make... Yeah, that's the right one. I always forget which is the right one. Okay. So let me just put this in my pocket and we will continue. Okay. So... In some cases, if you have extra copies of the gene, then there is regulation like repression, which causes you to cuts down the amount of protein that you make. But in many genes whose protein is produced constitutively, if you have more copies of the gene, you make more message, you make more protein. So people who have three copies of 21 make too much of some of the proteins from some of the genes on that chromosome. Now, even though aneuploidy of the autosomes is not compatible usually with full development, aneuploidy of the sex chromosomes is relatively common as long as there is at least one X. So there are people who are XO and XXY, in addition to the usual XX and XY. Now remember, the sex chromosomes are a pair, in which the X is a very large chromosome and the Y is quite small, carrying relatively few genes. And normally, an XX individual human is female and an XY is male. And that's because there are genes on the Y that are critical to being male. Now, by the way, how do we know that? You notice that there's two differences here. You can say a male is missing an X, second X, and that's the critical thing. Or you could say that a male has a Y and the female doesn't. So is the critical difference the Y or the lack of the second X? Now, we have a natural experiment that gives us the answer, because there are individuals who have two X's and a Y, or two, or have only one X. What the zero means is there's no second sex chromosome. I didn't forget. I know it's supposed to be there, but this person doesn't have one. Well, it turns out that people who have XO are female, and humans who are XXY are male. So from this, what seems to be the determining maleness factor? It's the Y and not the X. I should tell you that in fruit flies, it's different. In fruit flies, it's the number of X's. But in humans, it is the presence or absence of Y. Now, individuals who are XO are female, but they have certain physical abnormalities and are usually sterile. And they're said to have Turner syndrome. And males who are XXY are said to have Klinefelters. Now, these individuals, relatively speaking, are very close to normal, especially people with Klinefelters sometimes never discover that they have the disease at all. I should say condition, although most of them have considerably reduced fertility, and I think all the people with Turner's are sterile because they don't develop the proper tubing. So how come the number of X's is not so important? An X is a huge chromosome. It's very large. It's somewhere around the size of 3 or 4. And yet, if you have only one X instead of two, it's not such a big deal. If you have two X's instead of one, it's not such a big deal. And one of the questions that we want to return to today is, why can you tolerate missing an extra X's? Why is aneuploidy of the sex chromosomes much less serious than aneuploidy of an autosome? Now, there's some other interesting goodies in the notes, but I think I'm going to leave them, and you can read them yourself. Now, I should mention, for those of you who are ahead of the game and printed the notes last night, that I discovered a few minor typos, which I fixed online and marked in blue. So you can just check. You don't have to print it out all over again. All right. So how do these aneuploidies occur? How do you get an extra autosome, an extra X, a missing X? The answer to that is due to mistakes in meiosis. And to see how that happens, though, first we have to look at normal meiosis. Now, we did an overview of meiosis last time. And this overview is actually on the bottom of 19B. 19C, I think. And I'm going to redraw it, but I'm going to redraw it from up to down so it will, because there's something I want to explain later. That before either mitosis or meiosis, if you have one pair of chromosomes, each chromosome has one chromatid, which means if this is a pair of homologs before DNA replication. Does this represent single-stranded DNA or double-stranded? It's double-stranded DNA. So I'm just going to write it as one line, but it's double-stranded DNA. So you have to have DNA replication during the cell cycle. So these two chromosomes have to be replicated. So now they have two chromatids per chromosome. And we know that if we were doing mitosis, and this is not on the handout, you would get two cells. Each cell would get one straight and one wiggly back to the beginning. But if you have meiosis now, you remember you have two divisions, and in the first division you separate the homologs. So I'll put the... I'm going to draw them sideways to match one of our other pictures. And then after second division, so in first division, we separated the two homologs from each other. And then in second division, we separate the two chromatids. And each becomes an individual chromosome. Now, I drew it like this because we're going to talk about mistakes later, and this picture is the basic picture we're going to start from. But we're going to leave this aside now and look at more detail. How is it that this process is pulled off? We want to go back and look at 19A. 19A has the details of the steps of meiosis and mitosis in parallel. So it's helpful to look over that again in order to see how they compare. We said last time that before you can have, and we said in that picture, before you can have any division at all, you have to double the DNA, and that happens in interphase. That happens during the S period. Then prophase is the first stage in division. If this is mitosis, the nuclear membrane is disassembled. The chromosomes start to stretch out. And you can see that they're doubled already if you look carefully enough. Now, in meiosis, so this is mitosis, meiosis. Prophase in meiosis is much more complicated. It's usually subdivided into phases, subphases, which we are not going to discuss, but which are explained in the books if you're interested. It can last quite a long time. In human females, it lasts for years. Because when a human female is born, her cells have gotten this far. But they stay in prophase. All the cells that are going to make eggs stay in prophase until puberty. And then once a month after puberty, one of them finishes the job. So since you can have, barring hormone treatments and other fertility treatments, since you would normally have menopause somewhere around 45, 50, it means that the eggs can sit around here in this stage for 45 to 50 years before they're finally ovulated. You finish meiosis and you ovulate. But to come back to what happens in prophase, again, the nuclear membrane is disassembled and the chromosomes start to condense and become visible. But unlike in mitosis, the homologs pair up. So you can see in your picture that we've got the wiggly and the straight right next to each other. If there were many pairs of chromosomes, each pair here would be together. While you notice that in mitosis, it's every man for himself, each chromosome is arranged independently of all of the other chromosomes. Now, homologs pair during prophase one of meiosis because this is the time when all the crossing over or genetic recombination occurs. The enzymes responsible for crossing over are found in cells at this stage and not at other stages. Now, the special enzymes you need for this are not the same as restriction enzymes, and they're not the same as splicing enzymes. There's a different set of enzymes which is responsible for pairing the two homologs up, cutting them at equivalent spots, and rejoining them. Now, we're going to ignore crossing over for today because as long as you're only following one pair of chromosomes and one gene at a time, it doesn't make any difference. But we'll see next time, after Thanksgiving, where crossing over makes a difference in terms of inheritance. Okay, what about metaphase? Now, what's the point of mitosis? We want each daughter cell to get one wiggly and one straight. So how are we going to line things up? If this is the metaphase plate, we want to put a pair of wigglies here so we can send one wiggly up, one wiggly down. We want a pair of straights here so we can send one straight chromatid up, one straight chromatid down. And you notice that's what we've got. As we explained last time, if you have 46 chromosomes, all 46 will be in this plane. One chromatid of each will be pulled up at anaphase. One chromatid will be pulled to the other pole at anaphase. But what's supposed to happen in meiosis? Who are we supposed to separate from whom? First division. Notice we're supposed to separate the doubled X from its homologue, the doubled wiggly. So this time, in the metaphase plane, we want pairs. So one half of a pair can go to one pole, and the other member of the pair can go to the other pole. So instead of lining it up every chromosome, we line it up in pairs. Now, we've only drawn one pair of chromosomes. What if there were more pairs? Let's just consider two. Suppose we had a cell with two pairs of chromosomes. So I'll line up one pair here. Suppose the other pair is a pair of short chromosomes. So there's a wiggly one and a straight one. The wigglies, say, are from mom. The straights, say, are from dad. So with the other pair, how should I put it? Wiggly on top? Well, why not? Okay? So I'll do the other one, wiggly on top, straight on the bottom. Is this the only possibility? It is not. And because of the way this works, each pair of homologs is lined up independently of all of the others. So, for either of these pairs, it can be wiggly on top, straight on the bottom, or the other way around. Now, what's important is that they can both be on the same side, both wigglies on one side of the metaphase plate, both straights on the other side. Or it can be one wiggly on top and one wiggly on the bottom. Now notice the difference. Here, when we go through first division, we're going to separate the wigglies from the straight. But in the other case, we're going to get one wiggly with one straight and one straight with one wiggly. So this is going to make a difference when you consider the patterns of inheritance. The critical thing is, if there are genes on the big chromosome, if there's a gene on the big chromosome, and a gene on the little chromosome, the two genes are going to be distributed independently. So whether you get your mom's big chromosome and your mom's little chromosome is equally likely with mom's big chromosome and dad's little chromosome. So we'll see the significance of that when it comes to inheritance, either next time or the time after. But the thing to remember is that the lineup of each pair is independent of all of the other pairs. So now let's go back to our picture and consider, what if we go from metaphase to anaphase? Now, in mitosis, what happens in anaphase? The big deal is that the proteins holding the two chromatids together at the centromere split in half. And as a result, each chromatid is pulled toward a pole by the spindle fibers. So we didn't draw the spindle fibers in here before, but we know they're there. So if we break the connection between the two chromatids, each chromatid is pulled toward a pole and potentially will become a whole chromosome. But what's going to happen in meiosis in first division? Remember, we want the two wigglies to stick together and the two straight chromatids to stick together. So nothing happens to the centromeres. They stay the way they are. And what's going to happen is we're going to pull one doubled homologue toward one side and one doubled homologue toward the other. So the picture is going to look quite different. Now we get to telophase. And remember, what happens in telophase is just put everything back together again. So we divide this, start dividing the cell into two small cells. We start putting back the nuclear membrane. And we finish, in mitosis, you finish the job and you get two daughter cells. Now, I didn't draw what's inside, but genetic-wise, in terms of genetic material, as we explained last time, how does the genetic material here compare to here? It's exactly the same as indicated on the top. But now, it's different from meiosis. We do have telophase, and we start to straighten out the chromosomes. But we don't, we're about to do a second division without any DNA replication. So there's no S period, no more DNA. Just the DNA we have, we're going to divide in half again. Now, the prophase 2 is usually very short or missing. Remember, we don't have any interphase in here. We don't have that much warm-up to do. So these chromosomes now go almost immediately into metaphase 2. So we've left out prophase 2, and we've just put in a metaphase 2. Now that means the nuclear membrane has been disassembled, and the chromosomes are going to line up. Now if we're going to line the chromosomes up, what do we want to separate this time? We want to separate chromatids, so we line them up as in mitosis. So we're going to line them up this way, assuming the poles are north and south. If we have many chromosomes, now if this were a human, how many chromosomes would you have? Well, what do we start with? We started with 23 pairs or 46 chromosomes, and now we'd be down to 23 doubled chromosomes. So these 23, each of them would be lined up in the plane, individually, like in mitosis. And then each one, now at anaphase this time, we're going to break the connection between the two chromatids. Finally, pull each chromatid toward its respective pole. Reassemble the cells, the two daughter cells. And we're going to end up now with how many daughter cells at the end? We really have four, because I have to do the same thing down here. Put everything back. Now I actually have four. But how does the genetic material in here compare to the original? Is it the same? No, this time it's not. It's half. Because what I've done is I doubled the DNA, I doubled the number of copies, then I cut the number in half, I cut the number of chromosomes in half, the number of chromatids in half, and the amount of DNA in half. But each chromosome still has two chromatids. And then in the second division, I cut the number of chromatids in half and the amount of DNA in half. Now, just one thing we want to mention. In the production of sperm, which goes on throughout the life of a male after puberty, you get four haploid cells at the end. But in the production of eggs, when you finally get an egg, at once a month, as one of these prophase cells finishes the job, you get only one egg. And the reason for that is at this stage, you don't have an equal division of the cytoplasm. In females, what happens is, in fact, you divide very unequally. So all the cytoplasm is in one cell, and there is genetic information in both halves, but the little cell on the top is not going to go any further, and it's called a polar body. And then when the big cell divides again to make two, one of them is big and one of them is little. So when you finally get down to the end, instead of getting four cells, you get one big cell and two polar bodies. So this one has doubled chromosomes in it. This one has single chromosomes in it. And this one has the usual single chromosomes. So basically, if you think about it, what we've done is one of these becomes a polar body, and then this cell continues, and one of these becomes a polar body. So you have two polar bodies and only one cell left. And it's bigger because it has all the cytoplasm that would have gone into four. Okay. Now let me ask if there are any questions about this before we leave meiosis and consider how meiosis and mitosis relate. Yeah.
Just in your prophase two, could you reiterate what you...
Well, I left out, he asked about prophase 2. I actually left out prophase 2. And the reason is that prophase 2 is presumably, this is sort of daughter cell 1. And apparently you normally have that, but you normally don't have much of a prophase 2. Prophase 2 is very short. So you go sort of directly to metaphase 2.
So are those single chromatids in daughter cell 1?
Here?
No, right before it.
Here?
Yeah.
No. This is stretched out DNA. If we have a daughter cell stage, it would be all stretched out. Okay, now we have talked about mitosis, and we have talked about meiosis. But how do they fit together? When do you do one? When do you do the other? Now, it depends on the organism. Different organisms have different life cycles in which meiosis and mitosis are situated differently. But we want to look at the general picture. So now you want to look at 20A on the top. Where we have what I've called the supercycle. Now the supercycle covers all the contingencies together. But we're going to look at the pieces of it, and the picture I'm going to draw is going to end up looking like your picture. Now let's consider the human life cycle first, because that's probably the most obvious. That you start with a single diploid cell. And of course, it was formed by the fusion of a haploid cell, an egg or a sperm from each of your parents. So these two haploid cells fused to give you a diploid cell. And that's called fusion or fertilization in the case of humans. So we went from haploid, top to diploid. And this single diploid cell formed by the fusion of two haploid cells is called a zygote. And if two cells are going to fuse to form a zygote, they are called gametes. So that's the general term for eggs and sperm. They are gametes. So the gametes fuse to form a diploid zygote, as shown in your handout. And then what happens? That zygote, that single cell, divides many, many times by mitosis to make all of your body cells. So we have mitosis and many, many diploid cells. Now, what happens to those diploid cells? Clearly, all of your cells are not the same. Most of those cells specialize. Some specialize to become brain cells, some specialize to become skin cells, liver cells, etc. And some of them specialize to become what is called germ cells. So we could put here, as a result of specialization, we didn't write it in, but you get germ cells plus all the other specialized cells, plus all the body cells. Body cells are called somatic cells. These are cells that either don't divide at all or they divide by mitosis. But the germ cells now are going to divide by meiosis. They are the only cells in your body that are going to do that. And those cells are going to divide by meiosis and give you back haploids. Now, when two cells fuse, you go from haploid to diploid. When diploid cells go through meiosis, you go back from diploid to haploid. So meiosis is what takes you back the other way. Now, you notice that in this life cycle, almost all the cells are diploid. The only cells that are haploid are the gametes. And this is the basic animal life cycle for all higher animals, that most of the cells, all the body cells, are diploid. But some of those specialized cells go through meiosis, they make gametes, but the only job of these haploid cells is to fuse and go back to diploid. So this is the basic diploid life cycle. Now, there are organisms that do sort of the exact opposite. Instead of being diploid, except when they're haploid, except when they're diploid. So how does that fit in? So if you go through meiosis in these cells, you get haploids. But these are a little different. What do gametes do? Do gametes ever divide? The answer is no. The only thing they do is fuse. But the haploid cells in this case divide by mitosis. And so you get many haploids. These can be individual single cells, or in some algae, this is a multicellular haploid form of the organism. And then these cells specialize. They specialize to form special structures in the organism, and some of them specialize to become specialize to become gametes. They're already haploid. But some of them specialize to be able to fuse. So this way, you don't get gametes immediately by meiosis. Meiosis happened way back here. You get gametes by specialization. They fuse, and they make a diploid zygote. But this is a basically haploid organism. So the diploid zygote is the only diploid stage. And so as soon as the zygote is formed, it goes through meiosis, and you go back to haploid. So if you follow the orange, or the left half of the cycle on your picture, you get the haploid life cycle, where the organism is basically haploid, the only diploid stage is the zygote, and you're back to haploid again. Now, what's the difference here? The trick to being basically diploid is as soon as you get haploid cells by meiosis, they fuse and go back to diploid. What's the trick to being haploid? As soon as you make a diploid, you go through meiosis and you go back to haploid again. So this is the basic diploid life cycle shortcut and the basic haploid life cycle shortcut. But there are actually organisms that do the whole shebang. That is, no shortcuts. Leave out the dotted lines. These organisms go through meiosis. They make a haploid. The haploid divides by mitosis to make many. Some of those specialize to make gametes. The gametes form a zygote. The zygote divides by mitosis, and you get many diploids. Eventually, some of those specialize and go through meiosis. So an organism that does this has both haploid cells go through mitosis and diploid cells go through mitosis. So that you have a diploid phase of the organism and a haploid phase of the organism. And organisms that do that are said to show alternation of generations. Now, many plants do this. Higher plants do this. They have a haploid phase and a diploid phase. But in higher plants, the haploid phase is so reduced that you can't see it. But in some more primitive plants, the haploid phase is actually big enough that you can see it. And the most, perhaps, clear example that all of you have probably seen is moss. Moss has this green fuzzy stuff that forms mats. And then on top of the mats, you sometimes see these little stalks. Now, it turns out that the moss, the fuzzy stuff, is haploid, and the stalk is diploid. So the way it works is, the fuzzy stuff is a multicellular haploid. Here. Some of those cells specialize, form gametes, and fuse. That gives you a diploid cell. That diploid cell divides by mitosis and forms the stalk. So the stalk is this phase. But then the cells inside the head of the stalk go through meiosis and make you haploid cells. Those haploid cells fall on the ground, germinate, sprout, grow, and give you more green fuzzy stuff. Now, the only term we didn't put in here, which is on your handout, is spore. We have haploid products of meiosis twice. When the haploid products of meiosis are only going to fuse again, they're called gametes. When the haploid products of meiosis are going to divide by mitosis and make more cells, they're called spores. So what we're saying is, inside the cap of the moss, cells go through meiosis and make haploids. And those are called spores. They land on the ground, and they germinate, grow, and make the fuzzy stuff. So, which form makes spores? The fuzzy stuff or the stalk? And which form makes gametes? The fuzzy form or the stalk? So where is meiosis? Meiosis is in the cap, right? So meiosis, you get spores. Spores, so this stalk here is what goes, the cap on the stalk, those cells go through meiosis and they produce spores. So that's called the sporophyte or the spore-forming plant. On the other hand, how do you get gametes? Some of the cells in the green fuzzy stuff specialize and few become gametes. So who makes gametes? The green fuzzy stuff. The green fuzzy stuff, some of those cells specialize and make gametes. So this stuff is called the gametophyte or the gamete-forming plant. Now, next time you go in Central Park or Riverside Park, or when you go home for Thanksgiving and you take a walk in the afternoon, take a look in the park and you will see, in fact, sporophytes and gametophytes. And this is one of the most obvious cases. Now, I want you to know this is the beginning and the end of the botany in this class. I would like to do more, but can't fit in everything. So this so-called supercycle then covers all the basic possibilities. And different organisms, depending on the timing of meiosis and mitosis, either follow the whole thing, just the haploid part, just the diploid part. We're not going to go into any more details than this, but if you go and work with a particular organism, then you're going to have to learn all the names and the stages and the details for that particular organism, but we're interested in the general picture. Now, there are some implications of this cycle that I should mention. One implication of this cycle is, how does the DNA compare in your skin cells and your liver cells? Well, your skin cells and your liver cells both came from the zygote by mitosis. So the DNA in virtually all of your cells is the same. And yet it doesn't act the same. So the question that arises is what is called the problem of development. How do the various cells that arise by mitosis, how do they specialize? How do some turn into a liver, some turn into a brain, etc.? And we'll talk briefly about this next semester. And then if you find that interesting, there's a very good course all about this. Now, there's a very positive aspect of this. Since the DNA in all of your cells and the chromosomes in all of your cells virtually is the same, it means that you can examine any one and know about the others. This is the basis of all forensics. That it doesn't matter which cell type you leave behind, as long as it's not red blood cells. Red blood cells don't have nuclei, so they have no DNA. But if you leave behind saliva, or blood with white blood cells, or skin cells, doesn't matter, any of those cells will contain your DNA, which can be typed using the methods that we've talked about. Another use of the fact that all of your cells are the same is prenatal diagnosis. And to some extent, pre-symptomatic diagnosis. That suppose you want to know if the cells of the fetus have certain abnormalities, but the abnormality is only expressed in liver cells. Well, it doesn't matter. Because you can take any cell at all from the fetus, and you can grow those cells up and examine their chromosomes and examine their DNA. You don't need a liver cell. You just have to examine the genes that are turned on in liver cells. So there are many techniques available for getting cells from an early fetus, of which the most common is amniocentesis. The fetus is surrounded by a sac filled with liquid called the amnion, and that's filled with amniotic fluid. And some of the cells of the fetus are shed off and float around in that fluid. So it's possible to get a sample of those cells and grow them up, and to either do a karyotype and look for chromosome mutations, or to analyze the DNA using probes, blots, PCR, etc., and identify chromosome mutations. And some people want to do this just so they'll be prepared. Some people want to do this because if the fetus has a really serious abnormality, they want to consider a therapeutic abortion. Now, whether this is a good idea or a bad idea is a question that's up to you. But the point I want to make is that we now have the scientific ability to do this. Now, I want to leave this now and talk about the question of how do you get aneuploid individuals? Remember we said that aneuploidy is a result of mistakes at meiosis. And now I want to consider how this happens. We're getting an echo, right? No, you don't notice it? No, okay. All right, so I want to consider now not a normal meiosis, but mistakes in meiosis. But before I do that, let me ask if there are any questions so far. And what we're going to do now is look at the bottom of 20B. Excuse me, 20A. Yes?
Why are gene mutations more common in older women if the cells are just sitting there? Like, what causes them to mutate?
Well, why? In fact, she asked, why are gene mutations more common in older women? As far as I know, chromosome mutations are more common in older women, but gene mutations are more common in men, older men. The argument is that a man produces sperm throughout his lifetime. So the number of DNA replications and the opportunity for typos in mistakes is higher in men. However, in women, the cells sit here at prophase 1 for many, many years before they finish division. And so the argument is that if these two chromosomes, this pair of homologs, has been sitting there paired for many years, the chance that they will unpair and finish the job properly is lower. So as the woman gets older, the chance of completing meiosis successfully without a mistake goes down. And that's why chromosomal mutations and aneuploidy is more common in the children of older mothers. But it's thought that point mutations, gene mutations, are more common in the children of older fathers. Yeah?
What's the evolutionary advantage of alternation?
What's the evolutionary advantage of alternation of generations? Now, I couldn't say that right off the top of my head. I don't know. But you do realize that it means that you have two forms that fulfill, have a very different structure and function. And that presumably is the basis of it, but I don't really know. I have to think about that. Okay. Now, how do you get, say, trisomy 21? First, we have to look at what kind of mistakes could occur during mitosis to give you abnormal gametes. And then what happens if you put the abnormal gamete together with a normal one? So now I want to come back to this picture, which is the bottom of 20A. So this is what is supposed to happen. The DNA is supposed to double. The homologs are supposed to separate at first division. And the sister chromatids are supposed to separate at second division. Now, mistakes can occur at either first or second division. These mistakes are quite rare, so usually only one mistake involving one chromosome or one pair occurs in any given meiosis. So now if you look at your handout, let's consider first a mistake at first division. Now, we've written that over here. And to make it fit, I'm going to draw it even further over. Now, what is supposed to happen at first division is the double straight is supposed to separate from the double wiggly. But sometimes, by accident, both of them go into the same daughter cell. So now, if we consider that pair of homologs, one has both copies, the straight and the wiggly, and one has none. Now, does that mean this cell is empty? Remember, there are 23 pairs of chromosomes here. We're assuming the other 22 didn't make a mistake. I've left them out of the picture because it gets too complicated. But there are 22 additional, there are 22 double chromosomes in here and 22 additional ones in here. It's only the members of this pair that made a mistake. All the other pairs separated properly. Now, what's going to be the consequence of this? When we get to second division, chromatids normally separate from each other like they're supposed to. So with respect to this particular pair, two of the haploid products won't have any representative at all. But what about these two? Each chromosome lines up by itself. It's two chromatids separate. So each of these daughter cells will get one wiggly and one straight. So instead of getting four cells, each with a straight or a wiggly, we get two cells with no member of this pair, and two cells with two each, both a straight and a wiggly. Now, the mistake here was at first division, and this is called first division non-disjunction. Now, that's peculiar. We could have just called it junction. The point is the two things that were supposed to separate stayed together. It's called non-disjunction to make it clear that these two were supposed to disjoin. They were supposed to separate, and they failed to do so. So it's called, this is a double negative, it's called non-disjunction. Now, what if the screw-up is at second division? So first division happens completely normally, no mistakes, no problem. Now we get to second division. Well, as it shows on your handout, what's supposed to happen, we're looking at the wigglies now, is the two wiggly chromatids are supposed to separate from each other. But suppose they fail to do so. Both end up in one cell, and the other daughter cell doesn't get any of this pair. Now notice I've drawn the two wigglies separate, because eventually they do the two chromatids do separate. The material holding them together comes apart. So eventually you have two chromosomes. But temporarily, they stayed together and failed to separate in time. Now, this is also non-disjunction, but this is second division non-disjunction. Now, we didn't draw it on your handout, but there's another possibility. There are two cells that go through second division. Either one of them could have a problem and could engage in non-disjunction. It could be that the wigglies do what they're supposed to do, but there's a problem with the straights. In which case, although it's not drawn on your handout, you would get a cell with two straights or a cell with no member of this pair. Now, the point of all this is whether you have non-disjunction at first division or whether you have non-disjunction at second division, you can get a cell with no representative of this chromosome or a cell with two. What does that lead to? What we're looking at here are only gametes. These are only haploid cells, egg or sperm. What we're interested in is when you get an egg and a sperm together and you make a zygote, and that develops into a person, what's that person going to have? So we have to consider now the possibilities. Normally, a person produces a gamete, and we're just considering this pair of chromosomes with one copy, and the other person contributes a gamete with one copy, and the egg with one copy meets the sperm with one copy, and you get a zygote with two copies. That's what's supposed to happen. But now suppose a gamete that has no copy of this chromosome. Say we're talking about chromosome 21. Normally, each parent's gamete has one copy of 21, and so the zygote has two copies of 21. But suppose one parent has a gamete with no copy of 21, and the other parent has a gamete with one. They get together. So now you have one copy of 21. Or suppose one parent had a gamete with two copies of 21, and that met a normal gamete. You'd have three copies of 21. Now what will happen, if this is the zygote, it divides by mitosis to make all the tissues of the fetus and then the adult. So what will happen? This individual will develop normally, two copies of chromosome 21. What will happen to this individual? What do you call this? This is monosomy 21 or monosomic 4 chromosome 21. This is not compatible with normal development. This will abort. There'll be a spontaneous abortion. This will not develop into a complete fetus. Now, what about if there are three copies of chromosome 21? What's this? This is trisomy 21 or Down syndrome. This will develop into a person with Down syndrome. Or trisomy 21, usually associated with mental retardation, although it's variable how much, and facial abnormalities, and often other physical difficulties. Okay. Now, this is how you get someone with trisomy 21, but how do you get a person who has Turner's XO or Klinefelter's XXY? So let's consider that. If you have a person who is XO, what gametes? Well, now we're talking about aneuploidy involving X chromosomes. Because that pair up there could be any pair. That could be chromosome 21, the two homologs thereof. Or we could be talking about the X and the Y chromosome. This could be, say, the X and this the Y if this were a male. Or they could both be X's if this is a female. So how do you get a person who is XO? What did the gametes look like? There are two gametes. When it comes to sex chromosomes, clearly nobody had a Y. One of them had an X, and one of them didn't have anything, had no sex chromosome. How do you get Klinefelter's XXY? One has two. Two what? Okay, so it could be that a gamete with two X's Metagamete with a Y, and now I'll make the Y smaller so it's obvious. Is there any other possibility? So we're saying an XX could meet a Y. An XY could meet an X. So this is a normal gamete with an X. This is a normal gamete with a Y. But the abnormal gamete could either be an XX, meaning a Y, or an XY, meaning an X. Now, let's suppose it's this one. Which parent contributed which? Where can you get a Y from? Only a man. So the father must have contributed the XY, and the mother, the normal. So which parent had an undisjunction? It must have occurred in the father. Now, did it occur at first division or second division? How do you get an XY gamete? Well, if this is the straight is an X and the wiggly is a Y, if you get none disjunction at second division, first division's okay, then at none at second division, what do you get? What's this going to be? This is going to be a YY. What's this? This is a double X. So this double X from a male meets a Y? No. So an XX from a female could meet a Y, but how do you get an XY? An XY is a wiggle and a straight. So how do you get both a wiggle and a straight in one gamete? Where is none disjunction? It must be first division. So if a male has first division none disjunction, you can get an XY gamete, and then that meets an X and so forth. So there are a whole bunch of problems like this that you can try for yourself in the problem book. And now we get to the question, how come you can manage perfectly well or almost perfectly well with an extra X or a missing X, but not with a missing extra chromosome 20, which is very small? What is different about sex chromosomes and autosomes in this respect? Now, when you think about it, it's a problem in normal people too. Males have one X, females have two. Either females have too many X's or males don't have enough, depending on your point of view. If we said that extra copies of a gene can cause you to make extra protein and that can be a disaster, why don't females have extra protein compared to males? Or on the other hand, why don't males have too little protein compared to females? Depending on which way you look at it, depending on which sex probably you are, the other sex has the wrong gene dosage. So there must be a compensation mechanism. And it's this compensation mechanism which is responsible for the tolerance of extra and missing X's. You already have a system for adjusting the gene dosage. And the bottom line of it is that in any cell of a human, only one X works. The other X is basically turned off and not transcribed and not translated. And this is called the inactive X hypothesis, or the Lyon hypothesis, after Mary Lyon, who figured it out. Now, there is an actual correlate to this which is visible. Dr. Barr noticed that if you look at the cells of females during interphase, in at least some of the cells, you see a sort of dark body. You do not see it in males. And this is called a Barr body. And a normal male cell doesn't have any. And this makes sense if the Barr body is the inactive X. During interphase, the other chromosomes uncoil, stretch out, and act as templates. But the inactive X chromosome just lies around, stays coiled up, doesn't do anything. This is a simplification, but this is the basic idea. Now, how do we know that the bar body really is the inactive X? What if you look at a person who's XO, or a person who is XXY? Now, XO, remember, is female, and XXY is male. And normally, females have one bar body, and males have none. How many bar bodies do you expect in these people? If the bar body is the extra X's, how many should you have here? You should have none. But what about an XXY male? He has an extra X, so to speak. He's going to have a bar body, even though he's male. He's going to have one. And there are other people with other abnormal numbers of X's as well who have the corresponding number of bar bodies. So we're pretty sure that the bar body is the inactive X. Now, I started a few minutes late, so I'm going to talk probably another 10 minutes. If anybody has to go to something, feel free. But I want to wrap up this topic. How do we know about this inactive X business? Mary Lyon figured it out from looking at coat color in cats. And since cats and lions are related, it seems to me sort of appropriate. She was looking at orange versus black coat color in cats. And the thing that she noticed is that male cats are either orange or they're black. Now, we're talking about the basic color of the cat. The cat can be dark, the cat can be light. And some cats, many cats have stripes superimposed on their basic color. They have dark and light stripes of black, that is black and gray, or they have dark and light stripes of orange, that is cream and orange. But the basic color was either orange or black in males. But in females, there was a third possibility. Some were orange, some were black, and some had patches of orange fur and patches of black. And this is called tortoise shell, or tortie. For those of you who are cat fanciers, this is not tabby. Tabby is the regular pattern of stripes, either up and down or whorled. But it's a regular pattern. This is an irregular pattern of black and orange blotches. And you've all heard of calico cats. Calico cats also have white, which is controlled by a different gene. Well, by doing various crosses, she figured this out. Consider the X or the Y chromosomes. The gene for orange versus black is on the X. So what's with a male cat? There is no allele of this gene on the Y. So a male cat either has an orange allele at the color coat locus, or the position of this gene, or he has a black. But what's with a female cat? A female cat has two X's. So a female cat has two copies of the coat color locus or the coat color gene. So what's going to be here? Could be two blacks, right? Or it could be two oranges. Now, this genotype is known as homozygous. Either homozygous black or homozygous orange. Or you say, this is a homozygote, meaning both alleles of the gene are the same. But there's a third possibility. And that's a cat that has one black and one orange. Is this possible in a male? No, it's not. Only in a female. And this is called heterozygous, or the cat is said to be a heterozygote. This is the patchy cat. So how do you explain that? What must happen is that in one patch of the cat's fur, the black allele is working, and that patch is black. In another patch of fur, the orange allele is working, and that patch is orange. Now, on any cat, it's random whether this patch is orange and black. But this patch is always going to be the same color because of the way cats develop. So how does this work? Coming back to our life cycle, we know that the cat starts out as a single cell, the fertilized egg, the zygote. That develops by mitosis into a ball of cells. And when you start, both X's are on. But when there are about 200 cells in the embryo, in each cell, one X is turned off, and that state is stable. This is one of those epigenetic changes. So in this cell, it's random whether the X with the O or the X with the B is turned off. But let's say the X with the O, and it could be the mothers or the fathers, it's random, is on, and the other X is off. But in this cell, the X with the B is on, and the X with the O is off. So the patch of cells that develops from this cell by mitosis, in all of those cells, the X with the B is on, and the X with the O is off. All the cells that come from this other cell are reversed. So we know now that because all the fur in this part of the cat is always the same color, we know that all of this skin develops from a single cell. One cell at the 200 cell stage divides many, many times and makes this patch. So all these cells have the same exon, they have the same, therefore this patch is always the same color. Now, this has been confirmed looking at many other genes on the X, that in general, in any one cell, only one allele works. So, how can a female cat can be black, orange, or heterozygous? But a male cat is always orange or black. Now, there's a book written by a woman who had a patchy male cat. It was so strange that she went and she researched it. She wrote a book about it. What was with her cat? He was male, but he was patchy. I give you a hint. He was sterile. He was a Klinefelter's cat. He was a heterozygous Klinefelter's cat. And those are the only male cats that are patchy. So what we will do next time, after Thanksgiving, is we will discuss how orange and black are inherited. Unfortunately, we didn't get to that this time. But bring back 20B, because you'll need that to do it. So have a good holiday.